Have you ever met someone whose work you really appreciated? Their artistry, their craftsmanship. Maybe you loved their book series or you watched movies they starred in or directed. You might have someone's painting on your living room wall, or jersey, or their quilt. Could be anyone, Laurel. Or you've got maybe all the original records to your favorite band. Now, whether you have or have not met the person, and maybe that's no longer even possible, but if you could meet that person, wouldn't it be the strangest thing in the world if when you met them, to completely disregard them? Just to utterly ignore them? Wouldn't that be weird? I love your work, but you? Not interested. And not out of nervousness, just sheer disinterest. That would be very, very, very weird. You have Tom Brady right in front of you, but you walk away as he begins to speak so you can buy his jersey? Not even to have him sign it? A woman has Paul McCartney right beside her at the airport, returning on the same flight after his tour. He turns to ask her what she thought of the show, but she puts on her headphones and starts to hum. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah. And obviously she doesn't, right? That would be really weird. And as weird and offensive as that would be, to reject the artist, the creator, whose work we love so much, that is exactly what the human race has been doing with its God from the fall on. It's been happening every day across the globe, and it's often happening in our lives, dismissing our creator. We, as God's sole image bearers, the only ones with that title, we're supposed to be his primary reflectors of his goodness and his grace. We look up at God's glorious canvas in the sky, and somehow we can refuse to even acknowledge him. It's grotesque. And it's actually pretty easy to do with our hearts. The content of this psalm, the argument it makes, has fittingly been called by some the single greatest argument against atheism. Just look at it. That is a powerful argument. Just look up. Are you kidding me? But it's also a judgment upon us as often poor declarers of God's glory. People who prefer the artwork to the artist and fail to give credit where credit is due. So to be sure, all of creation, it does speak of God. But David lifts our eyes foremostly to the place where we can never seem to get enough, the heavens. What we see in the sky, the beautiful sun, the moon, the starlight. Do you ever really just get bored of that? You know, I've seen enough sunsets. Sunrise, not for me. Stars, kind of boring. They're amazing. And they declare not their own glory, but the glory of God. In the heavens, the expanse above us, we have the sun that supplies life and light to us, the moon that carries us through the darkness of night, and all the starry canopy that can help us find our way if we are astute. Just like when some select wise men followed a particular star to Bethlehem. David sees these heavenly bodies among the rest of creation which speaks of God, as the foremost preachers, proclaimers, declarers of who God is. They declare loudly and in unison, not at odds with one another, in unison. Who do they declare to? Apparently not just some, not to the privileged, but to everyone, everyone under God's Son. Okay, so they have these purposes. The sun provides life and light, the moon, the stars give us, help us keep track of things and where we are. Because they serve such wonderful purposes as these, they educate us on when to rise, when to rest, what day it is, what time it is, where we are on our way. They speak of God's nature. Romans 1:19-20 says this plainly, reflecting on the creation and how it's before everyone. For what can be known about God is plain to them. To who? To everybody. Because God has shown it to them. Just look. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power, like Job prayed, his divine nature, have been clearly perceived. There's no trick going on. God's not holding out. He's been speaking through his creation from the get-go. Ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. So everyone is without excuse before these witnesses of God. How much are they speaking? Day to day. Day to day, today, 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 today. Speaking, 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 speaking. And I appreciated Glenn's reading. I'm not sure which version that was. I'm guessing the NASB. But it reflected in verse 1 the continuous nature. These heavenly bodies, they are declaring. They didn't declare once. They haven't declared in the past. They are declaring. They are preaching. In the same way, verse 2, this is an ongoing nature. Day to day pours out speech. Night to night, they disclose knowledge. This beautiful picture is taken right on our bike path over here. Speaking to God's power and wonder. So what are they saying about God? God is faithful. As sure as the sun keeps rising, so God is trustworthy and faithful. And his mercies are new every morning. God is endless, as is displayed in our ever-growing awareness of the universe. For the vast majority of humanity, we had no idea there was anything beyond our little Milky Way. Now we know there are billions of galaxies that we had not even known about. And God is shown as endless through that vision of the stars. God is unrivaled in his wisdom, his laws of gravity and energy are anything but natural laws. Things floating in air and being sustained. And he has unspoken power. He not only brought the world into existence, but he sustains it, apparently without breaking a sweat. A universe that we physically cannot measure right now, and likely never will. Maybe we can't. God sustains that. To look up is to look into a mirror that reflects God and to learn of his divine power. But of all the things that may be revealed about God in nature, David's focus isn't necessarily on his power or his faithfulness. He said, "The heavens declare the glory, the sheer glory of God." And that's David's entire focus. The constancy, the order, the perpetuity of the cycles we see, they all appeal to a reality beyond themselves and to something more glorious. So when you and I, when we go outside and we call a particular sunset glorious, sunrise beautiful, tree marvelous, a flower wonderful, you just have to know that the God behind those is glorious beyond compare and beyond articulate words. But all these things are speaking of God's immense glory. The goal of this sermon, by the way, is just to expand our vision of God's glory. That's it. May we see him clearer, because he is beautiful beyond compare. God's world speaks volumes about him. Not a single day passes, not one night fades, without an overflowing, overpouring of speech. When the psalmist says, pours out speech, he's saying it overflows. It's gushing, literally. Day to day, night to night, it's just gushing, speaking, speaking, speaking. Can you hear? People of this great earth, this wonderful universe, are you hearing? We're speaking of the glory of God. Day to day, night to night. Are you getting bored with that? Glory upon glory. Take a look. Take it in. There is so much being spoken before our very eyes, we would have to be blind not to hear what they are saying. And somehow we are. Often enough we are. John Calvin said, if indeed we were as attentive as we ought to be, even one day would suffice to bear testimony to us of the glory of God, and even one night would be sufficient to perform to us the same office. All we should need is one moment on this earth to see, wow, there's a big God out there, and should drive us to desire to know him. When the days seem to be speaking to themselves and the nights, there's a few interpretations we can take there. You could say that no day passes without this speaking about God and demonstrating his power. So every single day there's speech, which is true. Or we could say there's this progress in knowledge with each new day, with each scientific discovery. Side note, we do not need to be scared of science. That's just the exploration of God's work. That is a glorious endeavor, if we see it as such. And each new day brings progressive revelation about him and his wonders. That's a good thing. That's a beautiful thing. There is no contradiction there. Good science speaks of God. Do you ever hear that? Probably not. But good science, based on observation, is speaking about the glory of God and the wonder which it cannot explain within its own study. And you could read this like the days are talking to one another. Hey, did you see what God did? Did you see what God did? Or the nights are talking to one another. I don't think it should be allegorized like that. John Calvin himself, he thought that what the psalmist was pointing to was this established pattern, the cycles, the constancy, that the day-to-day, the night-to-night continuous nature, that it mirrors the glory of the one regulating them. And time is kept perfectly, just as the stars, just as the moon, just as the sun stay perfectly in their cycles. It can all look very random, what we see. A casual observer of the stars, it just looks like a hodgepodge mess. But as you study, there is incredible order, and they point to the unchanging nature of God. But we get to verse 3. I'm glad, again, that Glenn read the version he had, because it's different from the version I lean on. I read from the ESV generally. I think the NASB is great. They're both very literal translations. So, what do we have here in verse 3? Literally, it's something like this, exactly like Glenn read. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. And in Hebrew, the problem is sometimes words have to be supplied. Okay, here there's not even a verb until that last clause, whose voice is not heard. But it's just no speech, no words, voice is not heard. And so some words need to be supplied. One of them is a relative pronoun. That's what shows up in the ESV, which changes the meaning considerably, right? The ESV would say, there's no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. If they're speaking, we're hearing. Whereas the other versions make it sound like, no. They're not speaking. There's no words. Therefore, they're not heard. The good thing about this is that verse 4 is clear. And verse 4 informs us about verse 3. So, their voice or their line, whatever it is, the sound coming from them, the image coming from them, it goes out through the whole earth. The psalm is not about God staying quiet through his creation. It's about God being loud and clear through his creation. Their voice goes out through the whole earth, and their words to the end of the world. So, if you read from the NASB like Glenn did, you would come away with an idea that sounds something like this. There's no speech, there's no literal speech, that's the idea. There's no literal speech. They're not literally speaking words. Therefore, there's no voice heard. Yet, verse 4 comes, yet their outline or their voice, their utterances, they reach to the farthest extremities. So there's no question about the intent of the writer here. They speak and they speak loudly. And the ESV only pairs those two verses together a little bit more tightly. There is no speech nor words where their voice isn't heard. Because their voice, their line, their marking, whatever it is, their image, their utterances reach to the farthest extremities. Everybody has seen God in nature. This is why Paul can so confidently talk about faith in Jesus the way he does and express that without us coming into a saving knowledge of Jesus, we are doomed. Hear what he says, and he quotes from this psalm. This is from Romans 10, verses 11 to 18. For the scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame, for there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. So this is for everybody. For the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. No holds bar. But then we have some questions that pop up. And Paul addresses each one, as they might pop up in our minds. How then will they call on him whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have not actually heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? By the way, this is a huge impetus of our care for declaring God to our neighbors, to our friends, and to people all over the world. How are they to hear if we don't tell them? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. But they have not all obeyed the gospel. And just because God's speaking doesn't mean we'll listen, right? For Isaiah says, this is still from Romans. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? And the skies could say the same. Who has believed what we've been saying? We're here every day as a reminder of God. Who has believed us? Paul continues, so faith comes from hearing and hearing through the word of Christ. And we might think, okay, then there's got to be an out for people if they haven't heard, right? If someone hasn't been sent to them. Maybe this faith in Jesus can extend to everyone if we just stop talking about Jesus. If they just never hear about him, then they won't be liable. This is where Paul quotes this psalm and tells us that is totally faulty thinking. But I ask, have they not heard? He's talking about everyone still. Have they not heard? Indeed they have. For their voice, speaking about the heavens, speaking about creation, their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Therefore, everyone is without excuse. And we lean upon the mercy of God to bring us back. Of all those voices that speak of God, the psalmist declares to us that the preeminent voice that we should be hearing speaking of God's glory, the preeminent voice in the heavens, is none other than the Son. At the end of verse 4, it says, in them he has set a tent for the Son. It's like the place where the Son comes out from and goes back towards. And the heavens have set that tent. And when he describes this Son, cute picture, right? This is Bethany about a year ago, remarking on the glory of God in the sunrise. As the psalm goes on, and from the end of verse 4 through to verse 6, there's this emphasis on the sun and the sun's work and how that speaks of the glory of God. And there's these three metaphors that are given to us. The first is this glory picture as of a bridegroom stepping out from his marital tent. So verse 4 into verse 5. In them he has set a tent for the sun. The sun which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber. If you're wondering what that picture is, that's a happy man coming out of the marital chamber. Very happy. Because he's just consummated his marriage. That's a happy dude. He comes out beaming with joy and glory that he has a wife and that he's been able to enjoy her. So the sun, in its glory, reveals the same type of, I guess we could say, the joy of God, the beaming happiness, like that of a new husband. And then there's this other picture. Might seem kind of strange to us. Like a strong man describes. So verse 5, the second half. The son is also like a strong man who runs its like a strong man running his course with joy. And if we're wondering what that means, I believe it's referring to the son following its set course, and there's nothing that can deter it. It's like happily just flying down its course. Has anyone seen the movie Chariots of Fire? So it focuses on the story of Eric Liddell. And that was a man who, when he ran, I think he was like the sun running its course, like a strong man running his race, which is why Eric Liddell, who was a Christian, he described his running like this: when I run, I feel his pleasure. And that's like the sun. It's like nothing can deter it. Consistent, powerful, glorious, like a strong man running straight ahead. And no one can get in its way. But the last part of the picture, this third metaphor, has to do with the sun's heat. So verse 6, its rising is from the end of the heavens and its circuit to the end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. So is that a good heat or a bad heat? I think the intention is that it's both. So when the Septuagint translates this, it uses a word for heat that refers to excessive heat, like that used in Acts 28:3. Heat hot enough that an animal would flee from a fire. And so just as the sun points to God in the way that it sustains all things, provides life to all things, provides light to all people and creatures, the sun also can be a dangerous thing to be around, because the sun is hot, and the sun can burn, and the sun can expose. And likewise with God, beaming, burning glory. And this is the picture of the sun. This last fact reminds us of what Paul says in Romans. What we read before in the different passage, I'll read to you from Romans 1. It reminds us that the word spoken to us by the world, however loud and articulate and clear it is, it's only enough to call us short and to expose us to the heat of judgment. But it cannot give us what we need to turn to God and be saved. We need something else. And so we can't hope to turn to God by just going to the beach and just walking the bike path and just exploring nature and just looking at the stars. We have to look at the God who has revealed himself in Scripture, and the God who has manifestly revealed his glory in his Son. Not the Son, his Son. Romans 1:18-23. You see, it's not just that God's revealed from heaven, but God's wrath is revealed because we resist what they are trying to tell us. If you were wrestling with what I was saying about our place of guilt before God, even if we haven't heard Jesus proclaimed, this is the passage that will explain it to you. Take it or leave it. But this is the clear explanation. So Romans 1:18-23. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness, this is key, suppress the truth. So the heavens and the sky declare the glory of God, but the first thing we do is suppress it. And that is why we are guilty. Continuing, for what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power, his divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. Everybody, without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God. They might have honored his gifts. They might have said, what a beautiful son, but never said, what a beautiful God. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. He's speaking about us. Claiming to be wise, like so many are, who are casting God off, claiming to be wise, they became fools. Which is why Psalm 14 says so clearly, the fool says there is no God. It's utter foolishness to look outside and go, there is no God. But this is our state of wretchedness. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged. There was a swap that we all did and that we all sometimes do. There's a swap that takes place. And that's described as exchanging the glory of God, of the immortal God, for his images. For images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Verse 25, we exchanged the truth about God for a lie. So even though there's this overflowing speaking every day, speaking of the glory of God and drawing us to him, without God's merciful hand peeling back the blinders on us, we would continue to exchange the truth of what they are saying about God for a lie. And like them that Paul is describing, worship and serve the creature rather than the creator, who is blessed forever. So the moral of the story, and something we can learn from the psalm, is this. The world speaks volumes. The universe speaks loudly and in unison. And in chorus, they are praising God day after day, night after night, abundantly. So if you've ever fraudulently claimed that God hasn't spoken to you, that God is silent, he has spoken loudly, and he continues to in his nature, in the nature he has created, and in the word he has given to us, which is what we'll focus on next week. The world speaks volumes about God, but we are deaf and dumb and blind, so we hear them not, because we do not have the eyes to hear them rightly. But fortunately for us, it is not just the heavens. It is not just the sun and moon that declare to us a foggy notion about God. But praise God that he has spoken for himself articulately, clearly, in the language he has blessed us with. In words. He has constrained himself in words. An infinite, powerful God, subjecting himself to limited language so that he can declare his own goodness. And he has revealed his own glory most manifestly in his servant, Jesus Christ, of whom Isaiah the prophet prophesied. I'm going to go through these quick, but it's just too awesome. I'm going to read from you Isaiah 40. Not the whole thing. Parts of Isaiah 40, parts of Isaiah 42. And it's amidst this conversation about idols and how dense people are and how stupid to turn from God and to worship his stuff or to carve out their own stuff and worship that. And it gives a picture of his immense glory. So I'm going to hop from one to the next. The glory of the, sorry, this is Isaiah 40, verse 5. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. This is forward-looking. And all flesh shall see it together. He's prophesying about Jesus. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Verse 8. The grass withers. The flower fades. Even the sun will fade. But the word of our God will stand forever. Hopping down to verses 21 to 22. Do you not know? Do you not hear? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers to him. He who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in. Verses 25 to 26. To whom then will you compare me? That I should be like him, says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high and see. To the heavens, yes, and beyond. Who created these? He who brings out their host by number, calling them all by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from you? It's hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. And so we stand condemned, rejecting what is clear and what is prophesied. But Jesus was prophesied of. Isaiah 42, 1, and then verses 5 through 8. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. Thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and what comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it, and spirit to those who walk in it. Verses 5 to 8. I am the Lord. And he refers to Jesus when he says, I have called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you. I will give you as a covenant, that new covenant. I will give you as a covenant for the people, a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind. Praise God, he opens our blind eyes and our deaf ears to see him. Because seeing his heavens, we somehow miss it. But Jesus has been sent to open the eyes of the blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison those who sit in darkness. I am the Lord. That is my name. I'm not the sun, I'm not the moon, I'm not the stars. I am the I am, and I have made them all. He says, my glory I give to no other, nor my praise to carved idols. So the God who would not share his glory, what does that say about Jesus, who the New Testament describes? It's the glory of God. Jesus is that same one saying, I am the Lord. Just a couple verses from the New Testament to declare who Jesus is. And for us to say Jesus is anything less is to incur judgment upon ourselves. John 1, 1 to 3. In the beginning was the Word. A word. The word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So Jesus is this word. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Hebrews 1:3. Again, specifically about Jesus. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. And he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purifications for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in the heavens. In Hebrews 12, 1-2, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, of whom Jesus is the foremost witness, the foremost proclaimer, the foremost declarer, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, just like that son. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him, as the only Son of God, endured the cross, despising the shame, hating the shame, and is seated now at the right hand of the throne of God. To summarize here, the earth speaks for itself, and it speaks volumes, but it does not speak of itself. The earth, the sky above, the expanse beyond, speaks of God and of his unrivaled glory. And we with unveiled faces see them speaking. Do we hear what they're saying? The heavens declare the glory of God, not their own, even though they can't begin to approach it. Someone described the universe relative to God as like a peanut that God carries in his pocket. And so the heavens declare the glory of God, but they don't begin to approach it. Still, what we see is so big, so beautiful, so impressive to us that their collective voice absolutely mocks our doubts and our wanderings. We are mocked. We stand mocked by creation. If the Son could speak in words that you and I could hear, I would expect to hear something like, "You think I'm big? You have no idea. You think your problems are too big? You've got no idea. You think I'm hot? I'm like a flicker made by a four-alarm fire. You're impressed with photosynthesis? You should be. But my maker speaks life from nothing, takes life from everyone who disdains it, then gives his own to bring them back from the grave. The heavens must be saying, are you deaf? Are you blind? And without God's mercy, we would continue to be. And so we have no reason to boast over those who have not seen and have not heard. In our proud ignorance and relentless self-deception, we blatantly reject the obvious message heaven is telling us. And we do so in two ways, at least. We, one, pull down the spiritual blinds, put on our noise-canceling headphones, and we explain away the marvelous with the sound of our own musings. We say, there is no God. Because for us, to shut up, to simply look and listen at what God has done in creation would overwhelm us with belief. But belief in God is often too inconvenient for us. See, because what we don't believe can't hurt us or hinder us. Ignorance is bliss, and if I'm free from belief, I'm free from constraint. we've got to know that while we should never be afraid of science, we've got to realize that no advance of science will ever let us advance beyond our own pride. Because the appeal of unbelief is too tasty. Belief comes with liability to another. But unbelief, that makes me God unto myself. Until I die anyways. So what's the other way we dismiss the message being spoken loudly in the clouds? In one word, interpretation. Could say it another way, bad eyesight. It's not that we can't see, but that we don't perceive what we're seeing rightly. I think we can be like deer caught in the headlights. The problem is not the deer's eyesight. They see the light. They just don't know what's coming behind it. We likewise, we see these great lights approaching day after day, but we don't recognize what's behind them. And it doesn't end well for the deer or for us. The difference is the deer's mistake is defensible. It's biological. But with us, the deception is spiritual, and we are always part of the deception. Consider, when God said, "Don't eat the fruit because you will die," Eve and Adam weren't deceived about what God had said or what he meant. It was pretty clear. No, they were deceived about what it meant for them, what it meant to be God's own rather than to be their own gods. And so when the opportunity presented itself, they wanted to be gods too. You see, atheism is not the only way to self-deification. It's not the only way to ascend the throne. Plenty of people believe in a God, believe that all things kind of just work together. Everything's meant to be. Absolutely, I believe in God. The problem is, they believe in themselves too. But to say so plainly that we are gods, it would be too much for our conscience. I think we need something to hide behind. For Adam and Eve, what they hid behind was that fruit that they bowed to. Bowing to its taste, its promises, its glory. I'm going to try to be clear here, and I hope it gets through. Make no mistake, when we worship anything or anyone other than God, it is only ever to ensure that we eventually supplant him. And that is what happened in the garden. They bowed down and worshiped that fruit for a day, but it was with the intent that they would become gods. We do the same. We take our skewed vision. We look right at the world, the beautiful sun, the heavens, our children, in all of its brilliance, and then we fall on our face and worship it rather than God. Bodies and boats, bridges and buildings, beer and wine, even water for Africa. We worship the created things and ourselves for how we can leverage and fashion them. The world speaks of God, though. Do we? I don't think we will ever approach being safe and satisfied in God until he first allows us the mercy of being totally dissatisfied with his stuff. If we're satisfied with this life and the blessings in it, if we're satisfied with the temporal, and people absolutely can be so deceived, but if we are, how are we going to hunger and thirst for something beyond it? The heavens declare the glory and beauty and wonder of God. The heavens, the earth, even us in our present weakened state, we speak of the glory of God, even as we deny him and run away from him. My prayer for you and for myself is that God may grant us the eyes that hear what is being spoken. That when we look at the glory of the sun this week, when we go to the beach, when we take the bike path, that we would have the eyes to hear what is being spoken. The glory of God that is so far beyond anything we have enjoyed. We do not want to be like those who lap up the sun's rays, but miss the glory and grace of the eternal sun. The sun out there is beautiful, but it has a shelf life, and so do we. But the Son of God will burn with love for all time. His glory cannot fade, his brightness never dims, and no heavenly body can ever eclipse him. God is glorious, but we better keep praying for eyes to hear what's being spoken. It is easy in this life to settle for fading glories, isn't it? Is that not easy? To settle for a vacation home with sunsets, for a social cause, for a Lexus. It's so easy to settle, to find all our safety and satisfaction there. Many have and many more will, which is why Jesus made it clear that it's hard for the rich, it's hard for the satisfied, it's hard for the full and the comfortable to follow him. But take heart, because with Jesus, even the blind, like us, can receive their sight. May God grant us to see what the heavens are declaring, the glory of God. May you continue to prefer God to his gifts and to hear rightly what the heavenly lights are telling us. They speak of the glory of God, but they cannot hold a candle to him. And let us be like they are, declarers, proclaimers, speakers of the glory of God. I'm not just talking about evangelism. I'm not talking about less. But may our whole lives declare, day to day, night to night, overflowing speech. Because we're always speaking. I'm not the only preacher here. You are all preachers. I won't make any of you come up here, but you're all preachers, and your life is constantly telling a story. And it's constantly declaring someone's glory. Are you declaring God's glory? Amen.